Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. Today, my guest is Amy Goldstein, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist at the Washington Post and the author of the widely acclaimed book, Janesville, An American Story. The book was published in 2017 and charts the story of what happens to an industrial town in the American heartland when its biggest factory closes. Amy, welcome to City Talks.
Good to be with you.
So I'd like to start off really with getting your motivations for the book. Why you decided to write this book and why you decided to write this book now. So, why did you decide to take a deep look at the effect of vanishing jobs on one particular community? And then how did you choose Janesville?
Well, I began thinking about taking a look at one community that had lost a large number of jobs during the Great Recession about a decade ago and as the recession was ending. At the time, I was, for my day job at the Washington Post, where I'm a reporter, covering a very broad social policy beat. And I did a couple of stories for the newspaper about the ground-level effects of what happened to U.S. communities when lots of jobs were going away. I did a story, for instance, out of Florida about one community where the housing crisis was particularly strong, looking at people who were falling out of the middle class onto welfare rolls. Mm. And I just spent a couple of days inside a welfare application center talking to people who were just completely traumatized to find that their lives suddenly weren't the way they thought they were going to be. People who had always been self-reliant and now were turning to government help. And this struck me as something very profoundly different than the trajectory that people expect, at least in the United States, which is all about things getting better from one generation to the other, not the other way around. Yep. And from this, I began taking a good look at what kind of journalism was being done about this very bad economic time, both in the United States and internationally. And I noticed that a lot of the work was really about the macro view, about, in this country, then-President Obama's ideas for how to stimulate the economy and the political fights over that, and whether the U.S. government should be rescuing the banking industry, the auto industry. And what seemed to be distinctly missing was a lot of deep writing about what effect all this had on individuals and on communities. And that seemed to me to be a very big absence, and I decided to try to do my part to fill it. Go
on.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, you carry on, and I've got some questions on that, but you carry on, yep.
So in terms of how I picked one community, I had the idea all along that I wanted to tell this story through a microcosm. There was a classic book of sociology in the 20th century called Middletown, which was a study of what turned out to be one Indiana town. I had read it way back in college, and it had made an impression on me as a way to tell a story, just focusing on one community. So I thought a lot about what were the criteria that I wanted in a place that I chose. And first of all, it had to be a place that had lost a lot of jobs. And Janesville certainly fit that description. Mm. According to federal figures in 2008-2009, the county that Janesville's the county seat for, the main little city in, had lost about 9,000 jobs, an awful lot of jobs in a small place. I also wanted to be a community that had never before been part of what we in the United States call the Rust Belt, a place where economic times were a decade or several decades old, because I wanted to tell what the effects were of this bad economic time, not the accumulation of decay in a community. And Janesville fit that description as well. It had always been a pretty economically healthy place until this big General Motors plant that had been the heart of the local economy. It was the oldest General Motors plant in the company that was still operating until it closed down 2 days before Christmas of 2008. Mm. And I thought that was very compelling. So there were other reasons, but those are two of the basic reasons why I thought Janesville might be a good place to start to get to know.
And I guess it was a very deliberate approach, because I think this is one of the brilliant elements of the book, is that it's not just a snapshot of Janesville
in a sense of what it looks like at any given point. You know, you map and show through conversations with, you know, individuals across different interests how the unfolding issues took place through from 08 all the way through until you know, very close to the present day. Was that a very deliberate decision in the way that you wanted to, you know, to think about and cover the story?
Yes. I mean, when I began, I didn't know how I was going to tell this story. I just wanted to start to get to know this community and see what it felt like there and see whether people there were willing to be open and talk with me. But as I began to get going and decided that Janesville really was a good setting, I began to think about telling the story as a kaleidoscope so that you would have different people's vantage points reflected as the chronology went along. Because no community is monolithic. Janesville had been, you know, a pretty harmonious place, but even in a small city where people tend to get along, there are people who are richer, people who are poorer, people who are more progressive, people who are more conservative, people who are leaders in the community, people who are just ordinary members of the community. And my idea was to try to show what this enormous experience of vanishing jobs meant and how it affected people from these different positions in town.
Mm. So let's get into the specifics of the assembly plan. So just outline for us, the assembly plant's importance to the town's economy. You've said a little bit about the jobs lost, and the flip side, obviously, it was a major employer. But just paint a picture of the GM assembly plant, how economically important was the town, and then also I think, because you make this brilliantly almost right at the beginning of the book, it wasn't just the effect of the plant on the economy, but it was on the very identity of the town as well. So, but just start with, you know, its significance to the economy, and then how that plays out culturally and socially as well.
Well, as small cities go, and Janesville has a population of about a little more than 60,000 people, so it's a small city, it really is a place that has a sense of its own economic wherewithal. It had two homegrown industrialists who were very important in shaping, as you just said, both the economy and the identity of the community. One was a man who founded the Parker Pen Company, the pen-making manufacturer that has had manufacturing sites even in the UK. Mr. Parker was from a city nearby, and he came to Janesville in the late 19th century, was teaching telegraphy students and was working with a lot of leaky fountain pens and decided he was going to make a better one. And he founded what became the International Parker Pen Company. Its headquarters was right in Janesville. And then just after World War I, so early in the 20th century, another man who had come to town who was running a manufacturer of farm implements persuaded the then head of the new General Motors Corporation to buy his company in Janesville. And it started out making tractors in 1919. And in 1923, it started making Chevrolets. And it kept making Chevrolets up until it closed. So if you think about how many generations of people this plant employed, it was several generations. And it was a kind of thing where fathers handed job openings down to sons and daughters, and aunts and uncles were in the plant. And the pay by the end was $28 an hour, which is really pretty good working class wages. So it was both a place that kept this town strong, kept it with extended families local, and it also spawned a number of supplier companies that also employed thousands of people. The big company, for instance, that had about 8,000 people who made seats for the auto plant. Companies that made powdered metal parts. I mean, all these companies grew up around Janesville and the surrounding area because General Motors was there. So when the plant closed down in the middle of the recession, these other companies either closed or severely cut back as well. So there was an enormous ripple effect. And once these manufacturing jobs ended, think about what effect that would have on other little businesses in town.
Yeah.
Restaurants closed. Bowling alleys closed. There weren't enough people who had the money to play in bowling leagues. So there really was, as I said, quite a ripple effect through the texture of the community.
And as you say in the book, it had the broader effect then on the town's identity, and you allude to in the sense of it not only being the big employer, but actually through the networks and through the relationships that the workers had, the town's identity was very much shaped and formed by that. I think you've mentioned the local news bulletins were timed for the shift changes, and when wages went up, then sometimes prices in the local shops would go up as a reflection that everything was kind of intertwined and related to everything else.
That's right. I mean, the life of the community revolved around the rhythms of this automobile plant. So when that went away, I mean, I remember people telling me that there had been freight trains that came into town at certain times and bringing supplies for the plant and left town at certain times of day, bringing away finished vehicles, and people knew when to avoid the railroad crossings. Mm. And suddenly that stopped.
Yeah. And get into that. So what's your sense as to why, what was the decision, or why was that decision then in 2008 to close the GM factory in Janesville? As you said, it's been there since the 1920s. It seems to be a reasonably productive, well-managed, good worker management relations, producing, a good that is still reasonably required. There'll obviously very, some pressures on the recession. But, why 2008 decision to close it?
Well, if you think about what was going on in the automobile industry at that time, General Motors was in quite bad financial shape.
Mm-hmm.
This was almost the announcement that this plant was going to be closing soon happened in early June of 2008. And it was almost exactly 1 year later that General Motors did something unimaginable, which was it filed for bankruptcy.
Hmm.
It got out of bankruptcy eventually, but that was, quite a startling development in American economic history. So the company was hemorrhaging money, and this plant was making, it made a number of different kinds of vehicles over the decades. It made trucks, it made cars. And by the end, it was making full-size SUVs. Now, these SUVs used a lot of gas. They were gas guzzlers.
Mm.
And gas prices were very high at that time, and the market for these vehicles had really fallen apart. Now, General Motors also had a newer plant in Texas that was making the same kind of SUVs, and the company decided that it didn't need both, and it closed the older plant. The day that it announced that this plant was closing or would be closing soon, the company's board also announced that it would be closing three other plants in the U.S. and elsewhere.
Mm.
So it wasn't Janesville alone, but it was in the context of this very bad financial time for General Motors.
And much of the book, or in fact, the starting point of the book is actually, when the plant closes. And obviously you go back to talk about how they arrived at that. But really, it's about how, individuals, families, the broader community and, the politicians of different persuasions, how they were both impacted and then tried to respond to the GM decision. So can you, it's quite a big thing, but can you just start with how, individuals and families began to respond to and were impacted by the GM decision, and then, get you to say something about the broader community and then politicians, and then, we'll get into how they kind of responded. But what were the sort of impacts that, once the decision had been taken on individuals and families?
Well, that was a central question that I was really interested in, which is when an economic trauma of this magnitude ripples through a community, what happens? There were lots of stories being written about people losing jobs, but I was interested in the question of what happens over time? How do people respond?
Yeah.
So you just articulated the heart of what I went to Janesville to try to learn. And I should say, I arrived in town for the first time a couple years after the closing. I arrived just on an exploratory visit, the middle of 2011. So it had been about 2.5 years since the last jobs had gone away there. And one of the things that people I met started telling me was that I would notice a lot of denial. I would notice people saying, it's just a matter of time until this plant opens back up, until these jobs come back. And at the outset, I thought, you know, it's been quite a while already. How can people think that this is just temporary? But that was very much people's attitude for a few years, for some people for several years. Because this plant had been going for so long, and over its lifetime, it had lost products and it had gained new products, that folks had a very hard time imagining, I don't think through any fault of their own, but just through their community's history, they had a hard time imagining that these jobs weren't going to come back. So in many cases, it took people a while to figure out what they were going to do next, or as I came to think about it, what choices people were going to make when there were really no good choices left. And it was particularly easy for the people who had worked at General Motors itself, as opposed to the supplier companies, to put off these decisions because they were part of a union called the United Auto Workers, big union. And the union contract provided for the GM workers to continue to get extra layoff pay beyond their government unemployment benefits for a year or two. So many people could kind of coast on what was almost their full income while they were working for a while before it became clear that this extra pay, you know, post-job pay wasn't going to linger forever and they needed to start figuring things out. I think that people who had worked at companies like Lear Seating, the big seat manufacturer that I mentioned, and some of the other suppliers had to figure things out sooner because they were also part of the union, but their layoff benefits weren't as generous. So some of those people began to retrain pretty early on. And when we were talking about why it was that I picked Janesville, another factor that I was really interested in taking a look at how job retraining was helping or not helping in this community. And Janesville has a little technical college that was doing exactly this kind of vocational training. So it was some of the supplier companies laid off workers who went back to school first.
Yes, and you refer to and include the findings from the evaluation of the job retraining program run by the college in the both in the main body of the book, but also in the appendix as well. And it reads for depressing reading, although those of us that think about and do more economic development work more generally would find lots of familiarity with the findings from this particular work with other findings as well.
Yes. So as part of my research for this book, in addition to spending lots of time in Janesville getting to know people as well as I could, I also work with a couple of labor economists on this quantitative analysis of people who had gone back to school and not gone back to school after losing jobs around the same time in this part of southeastern Wisconsin, which is where Janesville is located. And the findings are pretty sobering. I mean, some people, anecdotally, I know, did well and they got new jobs. But on balance, if job retraining is, at least in the United States, a very popular notion for what people should do after their work suddenly goes away, what I found was not very encouraging. On balance, people who went back to school, more than half didn't finish their programs. I mean, that's not unusual. It's sobering, but it's typical of people who go to two-year colleges in the United States.
Yep.
And for people who finished even, they didn't do that well. If they got jobs, they started out at much lower pay than they had before. In fact, lower pay than those people who had not gone back to school and found new jobs. So it just wasn't a very bright picture.
So if I think you're right. I mean, it's the same not only in the UK, but, you know, in most other places. You know, the one of the standard responses to economic shocks is, you need to retrain and, acquire a different set of skills to make you competitive in the labour market again. One of the other responses which you often hear is, you know, well, look, if the jobs are not there, you know, you're probably going to have to move to where the jobs are. And did you encounter much of that, either thinking or in practice? Had people decided to up and leave Janesville and go and try their fortunes in other places? Amy, did you notice that at all?
Well, I think that's an interesting question, how willing people were to uproot.
Mm.
And what I found was that people were not very eager to move to where jobs were more readily available. In fact, if you had been a longtime worker at the GM plant in Janesville, most people there had a lot of seniority. And that meant that within the company, the General Motors labor contract allowed people to transfer to other plants elsewhere in the United States where jobs existed.
Hmm.
And that was a hard choice for people, whether to go somewhere else to regain their good wages or stay locally. And I know a number of people, including one whose family I follow very closely in the story, who transferred but commuted, and I mean commuted,
yeah,
very long distances,
yeah,
hundreds of miles. People transferred to plants in Texas, long way away from Wisconsin, and came home perhaps every month.
Mm.
The man who I got to know very well was working in Indiana, about 300 miles away. And every Monday morning, he and a couple of his Janesville buddies would carpool together to their jobs in Indiana. And after second shift, which ended about 11 o'clock at night, they would drive home through the night to spend their weekends home with their families and would turn around Monday morning and do it all over again.
Mm-hmm.
There was a term that these folks were called GM gypsies. And if you asked these folks, why don't you just move your families to where your jobs are? Everybody in the family would say, because Janesville's home.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's a classic where the tendency of the policymaker is to say, well, look, you know, the jobs are no longer here. It's rational for you to up sticks and go to where the jobs are. And yet, you know, as you say, we forget that, you know, over generations, people have grown up, both their own families, but their families before them in places. And they are very, you know, very, very, very strong ties to those sorts of places. And it's not simply as easy as to get up and, you know, to make a new life somewhere else.
Right. People have attachments.
Hmm.
And one of the things that I found striking, it's a number, but if you look at the population of Janesville in the past decade, if people had been fleeing to where jobs were more common, the population would have declined, and it has not declined.
I find
that very telling.
Yeah, yeah. So can we go back to, you had this sort of interest in where for some of the GM workers, they were able to put off the decision as to whether they would go and find other jobs. Some of the suppliers had to take those decisions much more immediately. How did the, because you talk about this in the book, how did the politicians sort of respond? You know, you had obviously talk about the Congressman Paul Ryan, you know, high profile Republican, you know, kind of lead in a response to try and get GM to change its mind. So, you know, there's that element. But how did the sort of government, the state government, the local government, how did they respond? And to what extent, you know, did they get involved in trying to, you know, to address this, address the problem, both in the short run, but I guess more particularly in the longer run and about the future of Janesville?
Well, starting with the short run, there was a widespread belief and a very, very, very strong effort to try to bring about a different decision on the part of General Motors, to try to persuade the company to bring a new kind of vehicle for this old, well-reputed plant to manufacture. So the state government and the members of Congress from Wisconsin and the city of Janesville and the next city to the south, this little town called Beloit, the county government, the auto union, all got together to put up a big package of economic incentives to offer to General Motors to try to induce the company to pick Janesville as the site for a new little car that General Motors was going to start manufacturing, thinking that if no one was buying SUVs in the bad economy, little cars might be the thing to try to sell. And as I explain in the story, there was quite a strong effort to have members of the political class in Janesville and Wisconsin talk to people in the top of General Motors. There's a scene in the story where there's a big delegation of the governor and, say, Paul Ryan, who is now the U.S. He's about to retire from Congress, but he's now the U.S. House Speaker, top man in the House of Representatives in Congress. Wasn't that yet, but he was already Janesville's congressman. They all went to Detroit to sit down with the leadership of the company and say, look, we have good workers. We've been a good producer for you for a very long time. We're offering you a lot of money. You should pick us and keep the plant going. And they failed. And they were shocked because this was the biggest amount of money the state of Wisconsin and all these local governments had ever gotten together to offer any company for anything to try to persuade it to locate within the state. And they just didn't imagine that the state of Michigan, which had an even worse unemployment rate at the time, was going to offer a lot more money.
And it offered a lot more money, didn't it?
A lot more money, yes. So this went on for about a year. So it's yet another reason why people in Janesville could quite reasonably be in a state of denial that these jobs were going to stay gone. At the same time, there were both governmental and community efforts to try to cope with what was happening. It wasn't if people were doing nothing about this. So, for instance, I mean, Janesville is a place with a pretty good charitable history, pretty good charitable track record. There are lots of nonprofits that help people in town because there have always been some poor people in town, just not people tumbling out of the middle class the way it was happening at this time. So these nonprofits got together. There was something called the Rock County Job Center, which is a kind of ground zero for where people, it's a government office, for where people turned when they needed help to figure out what to do when their jobs were going away, what benefits they could collect, how to try to apply for new jobs, even though new jobs weren't that plentiful. So the Job Center and all these nonprofits got together to try to coordinate their response to make sure that they were thinking about what kind of help people would need and not duplicating their efforts and do whatever they could to help people get their feet back on the ground. So this ranged from a big increase in the services of the food pantry, main food pantry in town, to a local library helping people with literacy. I mean, factory workers, some of these weren't illiterate people. Most of them had high school degrees. Some had gone to at least a little bit of college or gone to college. But, you know, factory work didn't require writing, you know, job application letters. So there were efforts to try to improve people's use of the English language. I mean, there are all kinds of nonprofit efforts to try to help people while they were just shell-shocked about having lost their jobs. At the same time, some of the business leadership in town, the woman who ran the main bank in Janesville and other business leaders in the region created a new organization. Janesville's in a county called Rock County. So there was something that was formed called Rock County 5.0, which was a countywide economic development initiative to try to persuade first the businesses in town not to leave as they were, you know, finding that they had fewer customers. And also to try to do what they could to bring new businesses, to attract new businesses into the area. It was pretty hard work, but they are still at it. So Janesville is, you know, it was hit hard, but it's also got a history of being a pretty self-reliant place. And I came to think that it was the antithesis of a place that just sort of lay down and stopped when this big economic blow happened. They really tried to do what they could. But it's hard.
Yeah, and did you get a sense, Amy, that Janesville And you know, the, as you say, the, you know, these different the not-for-profits and the business community, had they ever come together and sort of asked the question, you know, what happens to this town if the GM plant closes? Because I'm always struck by, and this is something you know I see in the UK where you see, you know, big employers that have been there for a very, you know, some have been there for a very, very long time, particularly, you know, where we do have sort of steel industries, for example, or even some of our car manufacturers. They've been there for a long time. They're big economic factors in the locality. And I'm always struck to the degree to which those places are asking themselves that question. I wonder if you know, if there was ever any sort of planning done, or at least thinking done in Janesville as to what are we going to do if GM closes, or was that just scenario never really envisaged, or there was always, you know, something else to be done?
I think the question about forethought or the lack of forethought is a really important one. One of the people who's a character in my book, I mean, it's funny to say character because these are real people living their lives in real time now, but they're also characters in a book that I've written. But one of these folks is a state legislator, retired now, but he was a longtime state legislator. And I remember him telling me that years earlier, a couple decades earlier, the city government had commissioned a consultant to take a look at that very question, sort of what's the future of the economy. And the consultant came back and recommended basically one word, diversification.
All right.
And most people thought that was needless. And didn't do much about it. I mean, the town government didn't do much about it. City government didn't do much about it. So it's not that nobody had ever thought about it. It was just, I think, hard for people, and I think this may be true of a lot of communities, to imagine a future that's different than its past. And, you know, I found it striking that people, as I said, just thought that the plant was going to come back. And I think that even though there was a big effort to try to make this plant as appealing as possible, its workers had a good reputation, people knew that it was old. And people knew that over a period of years, General Motors had been closing other plants. So there was this sort of hovering anxiety that had existed for a long time that maybe they would be next. But I think that at the same time, the more the plant was not chosen to be closed, the more people had a hard time imagining that would ever happen.
Yeah.
So I think you had two things going on at once, this sort of awareness that there was this big economic vulnerability, and simultaneously a lack of belief that it would really, really happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I think in some ways that the more places survive almost the, you know, the next round or the latest round of cuts, rather than being fearful of the next, they actually draw confidence that, you know, it'll never happen to them, I think, which is understandable. But in the long term, I think it always gives you pause for, you know, for thought and concern, doesn't it?
I think there's another question, which is that, I mean, this was a plant that at its heyday had 7,000 workers.
Wow.
I mean, that was back in the late 1970s. For a community of 60,000 people and the surrounding area, that's an awful lot of jobs.
Yeah.
So even if Janesville had started earlier trying to recruit other businesses, it's just hard to imagine they would have found anything of the scale of the General Motors assembly plant.
Yeah. And because you mentioned earlier on, you know, the Rock County 5.0. I mean, where is that? Is that sort of doubling down on, you know, Janesville's kind of manufacturing past? That's the future, albeit maybe in different industries. Or, you know, are they taking seriously the sort of diversification? We need to, you know, think about different activities and different industries, those that are of the more of the 21st century rather than maybe the 20th. I mean, how would you characterize, you know, what their thinking was and then, you know, how they took that forward?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. Over the 5-year chronology that my story tells, They had won, I'm going to say victory, but it's a qualified victory. The town was chosen by a company called Shine Medical, which was a biotech startup. And it came out of the University of Wisconsin, Madison, a major research university in the United States. And it's taken many, many years for Shine to begin manufacturing. It hasn't still, but it had to go through a lot of federal approvals for what it wanted to manufacture. And that's been a slow process, and also a process of raising the capital, which was hard to do when it wasn't clear whether the federal government was going to approve this novel manufacturing process. But I bring up Shine because not just that it was a kind of closest thing to a victory that happened in terms of recruiting new businesses during this time, but also because it reflected an idea that at least the city manager who was in town during most of the time that my book spans had, which was that Janesville had always been a manufacturing town, but wouldn't it be great to start to manufacture some of the newer ideas that are coming out of the university? Because even though Janesville is less than an hour south of Madison, it had really been very separate from Madison, which is the state capital of Wisconsin. So I think that some of the idea has been to try to, you know, draw the cultures of these places, which have been very different, together in a way that would be useful for jobs in Janesville.
Yeah. And I just want to get your reflection or thoughts on, you know, when you were there, the sense of, you know, how the leaders of the town, not only the political but actually business and community leaders, you know, how did they feel that the federal government was, you know, was responding to, you know, to their needs at the time? As you say, you know, 2008 massive, well, the Great Recession, as it's now been termed, you know, bailouts being offered to, you know, to large firms and industries, the federal administration offering, you know, to be more interventionist than it probably had been, and particularly to maintain jobs in precisely the kind of towns and place cities like Janesville. But I wonder whether, you know, that rhetoric played out, and, you know, how the leadership in the place and the community more generally, you know, how they felt about whether they were getting adequate support from and recognition from, you know, from the federal government, albeit during a very, you know, challenging a time when the economy was, you know, was struggling.
Well, I think it depends on who in town you ask.
Right.
One of the things that I think happened over the 5 years that I was writing about is that the political schism widened, the difference between Republicans and Democrats, as was true throughout the United States during this time. It's another way that I think Janesville serves as a useful microcosm. Mm. You know, the politics became harsher. So, you know, there were Democrats who were supportive of then-President Barack Obama. Paul Ryan is a Republican, a conservative. He had a very different set of ideas. Mm. Some people in town don't like his politics. Janesville is predominantly a Democratic union town. But they think that Paul Ryan's a pretty hardworking guy, or at least they, you know, admired him for that before he became such a leader in Congress and was more outspoken about his views on a really wide stage. I remember, I'm just going to tell you an anecdote, being in Madison just before the election of 2012 when Paul Ryan was on the ticket as vice presidential running mate to Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney. And Barack Obama was running for a second term. And just before the election, Obama came to Madison. So I was there that day in the audience listening to him speak. And he was talking about his administration's economic accomplishments. And Bruce Springsteen was traveling with him that day, the singer.
Right.
So, you know, he has these kind of working class roots, and he was singing a little bit about that.
Yeah.
And Obama was talking about how his administration has saved the auto industry. And listening to him, I mean, I wasn't standing with anyone in Janesville, but I was thinking, you know, auto jobs are back, but they're not back everywhere, and they're not back in Janesville, Wisconsin.
And given, you know, the decisions that have been made now, I think you sort of allude to it in the book, highly, highly unlikely that those sorts of jobs will ever return to Janesville.
That's right. I mean, unemployment in the United States is at a very low level now, and unemployment is low in Wisconsin. It's low in Janesville, Wisconsin. But if you look at the kinds of work people are doing, manufacturing jobs have, for the most part, not really come back.
Yeah.
People are doing other kinds of work and work that doesn't pay as well.
Yeah. Just to begin to close, Amy, do you think the experience of Janesville is unique? Or does it have something to tell us about, you know, the fate of some of the similar towns and communities like this across America? And in fact, you know, it's not just America; it'll be, you know, parts of the UK and indeed parts of Europe more generally. But is it unique, or can we, you know, does it have a broader set of messages or stories or lessons for us?
Well, let me make two different kinds of points. The first is that one of the things that I learned in Janesville is that it takes a long time to see whether a community is going to come back or whether it's going to fall farther. I mean, I think that takes years. And Janesville, I think, I didn't know this when I first arrived in 2011, but Janesville, I came to think, is a place that has been trying very hard and has a fair degree of resilience. But even now, it's hard to tell how well it's ultimately going to do. So I think different places have different fates, affected by a lot of things, only partly including their own effort. A lot of circumstances to dictate that, and it takes a long time to figure it out for good. But the broader point, I think, is that I wrote this story because I wanted to show up close what happens when good work goes away. And I wanted to show it up close because I wanted this story of this community in this time to cause people who might read my book to think about job losses that they've known, other kinds of industry that's gone away, other kinds of work that's gone away, and other communities that have nothing to do with the auto industry, nothing to do with the American Midwest. But I think a lot of people have had the experience of losing a job, knowing somebody who's lost a job, caring about somebody who's lost a job, worrying about whether their job might be next. And I wanted to tell a story that would help people think about what really happens when that happens.
Mm. And what kind of response have you had from the book? Obviously, I've read it, and I think it's a fantastic, a superb book, a brilliant, you know, way of getting into these sorts of issues. And I, you know, you can see that whenever you Google it, whenever you search for it, you know, you get sort of similar responses. But I wonder whether, you know, how has it been received, I suppose, by, you know, policymakers or decision makers? Have they engaged in, you know, the stories that you're telling and the implications of those stories more generally?
I've given talks to groups of policymakers. I gave a talk to a group of state labor secretaries, and not labor like your political party, but people who think about workforce development and workforce development directors. And this was a group of people from states with Republican governors. So they were pretty conservative policymakers. And there was a pretty lively conversation about when this happens, what does one do?
Mm-hmm.
I've also been back to Janesville twice and talked about the book to the hometown audience.
Was it well received there?
It was. And I've got to tell you, I was kind of nervous.
I can imagine.
because it's an act of audacity to show up in a community that's not yours and say to people, I want to understand who you are and what you've been through, and then to try to portray it for people who are even farther away.
Yeah.
So I wasn't sure how this would go, but people have really, I think, embraced it, as you say. I've been just delighted by that. I think that some of the people who let me into their lives as a journalist, as a writer, feel as if maybe what they've been through, people now understand a little bit better.
Mm. Fantastic. My guest today has been Amy Goldstein. Amy, thanks for being part of City Talks.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.